Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
Coming to the special edition of Bard's Logic, and thank you if you're either coming from in the chat or the archives listening later, or of course listening live through Blog Talk Radio or listening live through the Bard's Logic website. And tonight we have some special guests from the Sheldrick Wildlife Trust, and we are happy to welcome Nancy Hattabaugh, and the Secretary and Treasurer of the U.S. Friends of the Sheldrick Wildlife Trust, and also Angela Galdino, and if I mispronounce any of these names, ladies, please correct me, and she is one of the board members of the Sheldrick Wildlife Trust, and the music you just heard was composed by Julia Newman, who will be giving a testimony this evening on her experiences during the time she spent at one of the orphanages in Kenya. Now, a little bit about the Sheldrick Wildlife Trust, is that it's an organization, and they could fill in some more of this, of course, dedicated to saving, for one, baby elephants, wildlife conservation and education, and the fight against poaching. And we have that the trust has played an extremely significant conservation efforts since it was founded in 1977, and also speaking out when necessary on controversial issues and stepping in unobtrusively and rapidly to bridge a gap or meet a shortfall that jeopardizes wildlife during the times of governmental economic constraints. The organization has also been featured on National Geographic, Animal Planet, and CBS's 60 Minutes. So without further ado, what I'll do is I will open up the mics to both Nancy and Angela. And welcome, whoop, let me open up this one. And welcome, ladies, and thank you for coming.
Thank you,
thank
Robert.
You.
And we'd like to talk a little bit about the trust. Thank you for giving us that opportunity to share with your listeners this beautiful story about the David Sheldrick Wildlife Trust. The trust was founded in 1977 by Dame Daphne Sheldrick in memory of her late husband, David Sheldrick. David was the first warden of Tsavo National Park, which is the biggest park in Kenya. And after his death, she decided to, the Kenyan government asked her to help in raising some orphans, baby elephants and rhinos. So she officially started the trust in 1977. And Dame Daphne was the first person to ever figure out a formula, a milk formula, that baby elephants can drink and survive, because they cannot stand the cow's milk. They cannot digest the fat in cow's milk. So a lot of them died in the first few years. So she finally figured out a formula that they could survive on and thrive. And since then, she has raised over 150 baby elephants, and over 100 of them are now living wild, like normal elephants.
Oh, wow, that's great.
Yeah. So it has been a wonderful story, a great, also, I don't know if you know, but Daphne Sheldrick was knighted by the Queen of England. And she's the only Kenyan to be knighted by the Queen. And she is the top expert in the world in raising baby elephants.
Wow. Very, very interesting. That is something I did not know.
Yeah.
And I believe this is Angela we're speaking with, correct?
Right.
Okay. Okay, great. I just want to definitely make sure I put a name to the voice. I was pretty sure. I just wanted to make sure. And hello, Nancy, if there's anything you'd like to chime in before I get to the questions. You did kind of start to answer some of the first one, but if there's anything else you'd like to chime in more about it after I ask it, go ahead. But anything you'd like to chime in on that, Nancy?
No, I think she covered it.
Okay, great. Well, then I guess we shall proceed to the first question I have here. And as I said, in part, you did answer it. And so if there's anything to elaborate on, go ahead. And the first question is, of course, I'd like to start with getting some background, which you already have given, and some historical information about the organization. And I believe you also answered how and when the organization got started. But what was the impetus for the inception of the Sheldrick Wildlife Trust? What was the starting motivation behind it?
Well, when she married David, they lived in Tsavo, and they raised all kinds of orphans over there. Elephants, rhinos, zebras, buffalo. And so she was probably the only one in the country that had expertise in how to raise, you know, wild animals. So when they moved back to Nairobi, and 6 months later, David passed away. So the Kenyan government asked her to keep, you know, to help them to raise these babies. There were, you know, showing up orphans everywhere. And with the help of African Wildlife Foundation, who had set up a fund to in David's name to just, you know, pay for the projects that he started. Then she was encouraged by the African Wildlife Foundation to start his own fund in his name, and she did. And that's how the trust got started. And, you know, it has been nonstop since then.
Okay. And then, of course, you know, Nancy, at any time you'd like to chime in, go ahead. If not, I could go on to the next question. So it's pretty fluid, pretty organic interview. So go ahead. We have some structure, of course, but go ahead, Nancy.
So as Angela said, the trust just continued to grow. The awareness has grown over the years, and more people are finding out about the David Sheldrick Wildlife Trust and the importance regarding what they do. So it's just continued to grow. In 2004, we formed a U.S. arm, which is known as the U.S. Friends of the David Sheldrick Wildlife Trust. In the same year, we also formed an arm in the United Kingdom. So we're able to spread awareness and keep the project going.
Great. So it definitely has an international, spread out internationally then.
Yeah, international awareness. Yeah, and Angela Sheldrick, who now runs the trust, she started the adoption program, which has been extremely successful. And also, I think it was 2005, BBC did the Elephant Diaries, and that, you know, gave great visibility to the trust. And I actually learned about the trust when I watched it on Animal Planet.
Oh, okay.
And since then, you know, like you said, CBS 60 Minutes was there. Then they also made the Born to be Wild movie about the elephants, which was one of the most successful movies that was made by IMAX. And so, you know, it's on the news quite a bit. In fact, in August, Chelsea Clinton was there to film a segment on the trust.
Interesting. I believe I read that somewhere. I believe I read that somewhere that she did that.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, well, on with the next one here is, before we go into details about what the Sheldrick Wildlife Trust does, if you ladies could give a synopsis of the programs that have been initiated there.
Besides raising the elephants and the rhinos, the trust also protects the environment where the elephants are going to live. And we set up like now 8 desnaring teams, which, you know, protect and patrol the park, which the Tsavo National Park, which is 8,000 square miles. It's a huge park. So
wow.
They go around the park, you know, collecting snares and also making sure that there are no poachers around. And that's one of the projects there. Then the trust also has 2 full-time mobile vet units, which treat animals there have been injured or they're sick, and in both the Masai Mara and the Tsavo National Park. It has a community outreach program to educate the community surrounding the park and, well, the park in Nairobi and also in Tsavo, you know, to educate the people about the value of their wildlife heritage. And that they do, they take students on bus trips to see the elephants. They show movies in the schools about the elephants and about, you know, conservation efforts. the trust also gives them, they raise tree samplings so that the students will go and plant trees in the park. And so they take interest in, you know, in conservation early on. It also has a program of a radio program that in 42 different dialects. Kenya has between, I think it's 44 different tribes, and each one has their own language. So, you know, the radio program is done in all different languages so that they can reach as many people as possible. Just, you know, sensitizing people of the need to protect wildlife, and they have been amazingly successful in, because a lot of times now when people see elephants in distress, either hurt or a baby that, you know, is alone, they know they won't survive, so they call the trust, and then the trust dispatches a airplane to go pick up that orphan. So there are several programs, and also, you know, taking care of the wild habitats, protecting them, and reforesting some areas that have been badly, the trees have been cut down. So there are several projects going on right now with the trust.
And actually, I think that's a go ahead, Nancy. Chime in, because I don't want to interrupt anybody. So if I start in with the next question and someone wants to chime in, just feel free to interrupt me. That's fine.
Another thing the trust does as far as community outreach is they're very concerned about human-wildlife conflict. So they've built many fences to help keep animals, wildlife out of crops, human crops, and keep the humans from getting into the forest and cutting down the trees and different things like that. We also pay, we don't just build the fences, we pay for funding and upkeep of the fences.
Mm-hmm.
So we have huge spans of fence that have been built in order to help with the human-wildlife conflict.
The trust also has, I forgot to mention that, it has some two super cub planes, little small planes, that patrols the park, you know, to prevent poaching and
oh, I see.
Yeah, which is done daily. And that has been extremely helpful with the desnaring teams because they communicate through radio. If the pilot sees some areas of problems or something, they radio he radios to the desnaring team, then they go and check what's going on in that area.
Okay, and then when you mentioned conservation, and I know that is one of the areas of concentration. And is there any other different conservation initiatives the organization is working on currently or looking to work on, you know, anything planned to expand? And could you give specifics on the individual initiatives, such as your water conservation efforts?
Sure. The trust right now has two areas besides Tsavo, which is the main area of that we actually work on. It has gotten a lease on the Kibwezi Forest, which is close to Tsavo National Park. And that forest is called the Umani Springs, and which is a beautiful forest in Kenya, and had been seriously, the trees have been cut down, you know, logging. And there were a lot of snares in that area. So it got a lease from the Forest Department to protect that area. So actually the U.S. Friends organization paid for an electric fence around this forest And they built a self-help lodge there, and all the proceeds will go to protect this forest. And also, last year, it started a community program with the communities on the coast. It's called Amu Ranch, and it's protecting like 60,000 acres of land, because it had been badly, the trees had been badly cut down and invaded by cattle. So the communities were ecstatic with, you know, coming, with the trust coming in and doing all the work there. We have built roads, and now the animals are coming back because they feel safer. And also we patrol, we got a super cub for that area that's going to be patrolling that area as well. And on the water initiatives, the trust has, I guess it's built 5 boreholes and 3 windmills that it paid for and maintains on an ongoing basis. And those, you know, that provides water for the animals in the northern part of the park, which is extremely dry.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have these water holes, and the windmills pump underground water to those water holes for wildlife to come and drink. So it relieves the pressure on the. There are only 2 rivers in the park.
Mm-hmm.
So when they, you know, doing that relieves the pressure on those rivers. And like this year, they've had a very bad drought. And the park is very, very dry. So the animals use those water holes extensively. And also there's, I think there's a windmill on the outside of the northern boundary for, there's a tribe called Orma that lives in the northern part of the park. So to keep them from bringing their cattle into the park, which caused a lot of problems for wildlife. And so they put a borehole there to give water to that community as well. So there are several projects that are on an ongoing basis there. Nancy, you have something to add?
You know, what's interesting about the water holes is during times of serious drought, the wild animals know to come to the trust for water. They come to Afumba and Voi for drinking water. Some of our ex-orphans that have grown up and gone back into the wild will bring their wild friends back to the boreholes to drink. So that's very interesting how that's happened.
Yeah.
Well, and you mentioned community outreach or about the surrounding communities.
Mm-hmm.
And your organization does do community outreach programs. If you could tell us more about it, what type of educational programs do you provide?
Well, the trust, they make films about the elephants and other wildlife, and they go and show to the school kids. And, you know, to sensitize and to show them the value of their wildlife heritage, because Kenya gets a lot of dollars from tourists that come to see, you know, go on a safari, to see the animals, and that has a huge impact on the communities. And, you know, if the kids know that they are supposed to protect those animals, you know, it's for their own self-interest too, and so they show those films. They take the kids on school buses to the stockades, because a lot of the kids have never seen an elephant, and that in not an elephant, and they have never been on a bus before. So for them, it's like an experience of a lifetime. They love it. And also the trust donates metal desks to the schools,
mm-hmm.
and sports equipment. And I already mentioned about the tree sampling that they plant. And all kinds of, if you go to Nairobi, because in Nairobi where the nursery is, from 11 to 12 every day, you know, it's open to the public. They come and see the elephants, drink their milk, and then take a mud bath and play. You see at least half of the people that are there are little school kids. They come by.
What you do things in other than just Kenya. You said you have initiatives in Nairobi as well?
You have a lot of tourists that come to see. It's one of the attractions in Nairobi. If you go there, or you have to go to the Sheltered Trust. It's quite an amazing sight to see, you know, the little elephants. Yeah. And so the kids, you know, going there, for them, it's fantastic because they learn, they touch the elephant, it becomes real for them, you know, and early on they learn that they should be protecting, you know, their wildlife.
Well, it's interesting. I knew about the over in Kenya, but I didn't know about the Nairobi. That's a good addition to my knowledge.
Yeah, well, the trust has three stations. One in Nairobi for the babies from they are days old until they are 3 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And then from there they go to live a more independent, but still keeper dependent. But they go to Tsavo National Park, either to Ithumba or to Voi. And that's where they begin the reintroduction back into the wild, the wildlife.
No, that's fascinating.
So slow, and that's a process that takes between 5 and 7 years.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
So because they have to learn to be elephants. They don't have the mothers there to teach them. So the keepers take them out every day, teach them how, you know, where they should go, things to avoid, what they should eat.
Wow.
Yeah. And then they, of course, they meet the elephants that have already gone wild. They used to be orphans, but now live wild. And they meet them out in bush every day.
Wow. Wow, that's incredible.
It's very amazing. All the orphans, the ones that are still keeper dependent, that live in the stockade, and the ones that are now wild, they see themselves as one big family. So the older elephants that live wild now, they come almost every day to check on the babies, make sure they make sure that they are okay, and meet them, you know, out, they go out with them. And
well, that'd be fascinating to see. Wow.
It is very fascinating.
Wow. And before I continue on, I'd like to talk about more about the animal welfare goals. Tell us more about your mobile veterinary project, and how many animals a year would you say, approximately, you save from this project?
Okay, the trust has two mobile vet units, and one is in the Masai Mara area, and the other one is in the Tsavo area. I think the Masai Mara is a more recent one. It was established, I want to say, in 2007. And the Tsavo one is an older one. I'm not exactly sure when it was established, but they treat all kinds of all kinds of animals, for snares, injuries, rescues, you know, disease. A lot of them have mange, I guess it's called, a skin disease that ends up killing the animal. So they treat them for that. And I have some numbers here for the Mara vet unit. Since inception, they have treated about 301 animals. And the Savo vet unit has treated about 466 animals.
Wow.
Yeah, so it's quite an effective a program to have. And these are funded by an Austrian organization called Fierpaten, which means, I'm not exactly sure, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing it right, but it means four paws. They're an animal organization in Austria.
It's in Austria. Wow.
In Austria, yeah, they have sponsorships from everywhere. I mean, the U.S.,
wow.
U.K., France, Germany, Japan, Australia, Austria, Switzerland,
Canada.
So this is definitely international.
Yeah, very, very international. Yeah.
Well, actually, you said Australia, so it really kind of brought me to this question. It's the way it just went in. Describe to the audience what is meant by bushmeat. See, the bush, you know, Australia bush, okay.
You know, like...
It made me think of the next question. But, I mean, if you have more on this one, we can move to that one. I just brought that up, so go ahead. I'm sorry if I interrupted you.
Nancy, do you have anything else?
I just wanted to say in regard to the vet units that it's interesting that often an injured animal will return to Voi or Athumba for help. Most recently, we had an elephant that was had five arrows in its body.
Oh, my God.
It returned to Voi because it knew that it could get help there. So they summoned the vet units and were able to remove the poison arrows. I don't know that they were poison, actually, but they were able to remove the arrows and rehabilitate the wild orphan, and once it got back on its feet, it went back off into the wild. So they know to return there for help. And on a couple of occasions, we've had mother elephants bring their babies there for help. One had a snare around its leg, and it brought it to the to Voi for help. So,
yeah, they do that. It's quite amazing.
Well, yeah, just the memory. You know, we could talk about that later, about the memory of elephants. You know, you'll always hear about an elephant never forgetting. With a big brain like that, you would think it would.
That's right. But they not only remember, but they have formed a great deal of trust for the keepers and know that the keepers will help them.
Well, almost like a dog in some aspect, or maybe, or a cat or something like that.
Yeah.
Is what it sounds like to me, at least. I'm no expert about animals by any stretch of the imagination, but,
Right. That's
what it sounds like to me. Okay, well, this will be the last question before we bring Julia in about her testimony when she was there in Kenya. And I believe there's other countries she was in there as well when she was over in Africa. But the last question is I did mention it a little bit when you talked about Australia. Describe to the audience what is meant by bushmeat, the bushmeat threat, and why is this a danger to the wildlife inhabitants?
Well, the bushmeat is, in Kenya, it's illegal to hunt any wild animal. And what happens is, you know, with the population explosion, people go into the park and, you know, kill an animal or snare one, an impala, whatever, an elephant, a giraffe, anything can get snared. And then they come back, kill, you know, the animal has probably died of a slow and painful death, and they take that, you know, scan the animal and take it home to eat. That is one, you know, subsistence kind of problem. And now the other one is that people that go to the park to do the same thing, get the animals, and then they sell the meat. You know, and that has been done all over Africa. And if you go to West Africa, there are hardly any animals left because they have been eaten. They don't have any wildlife anymore in West Africa. And that is a huge threat in everywhere in Kenya. So that is a big problem. And that's why, you know, the snaring teams go in and they collect, the animals cannot see the snare. And it's not just for the elephants to, you know, get the tusks, or it's any animals. The ones that, you know, they will eat an impala.
That's like a cat, isn't it? Is it impala?
Impala is
like
an antelope.
Like a wild cat or antelope. See, I told you I'm not very expert on the animals.
You'll become one very soon.
I tell you, I'm learning a lot tonight. Thank you very much. Yeah, my concentration is definitely something else other than animals. But it is definitely an interest of mine, especially when I was speak with someone, and we'll talk about this more in depth later about the poaching, how your work towards curtailing poaching is that's a activity that I absolutely abhor. And when I seen that it's something you folks work on, I really wanted to increase the awareness, of that. So, but I digress. This is a show about my lack thereof of animal knowledge. So go ahead.
Well, one thing the trust does in order to help with the threat of bushmeat is they actually look for places where people are finding the materials that they use to make the snares. Oftentimes they use old tires, and they pull the wire out of the old tires or old telephone line. So the trust is very active in finding areas where these materials exist, and they clean up those areas. For example, they cleaned up 180 kilometers of disused telephone wire along a railway, and that was an ongoing source for people to find and make the snares with. And again, it's a very ugly thing. It's just, it's horrible the way they make them, and then the animals just suffer a horrific death. It's not like hunting with a gun where they shoot the animal and it's dead, you know, in a matter of a couple of minutes. It's just an ongoing, they're just tortured until they die.
Yeah.
Wow. That is terrible. That is terrible. And then I'm looking down the list, and what I like to cover after we're bringing Julia in is when we talk a little bit more about the desnaring and talk more about the the poaching. Well, that's laying down. But also later on, we'll like to touch more on the poaching and what these animals are being poached for. Of course, I'm sure a lot of folks know, but I mean, I think if they would hear more in detail of what happens, then I think that'd be really, I think it'd be a really good thing. So if you guys don't have anything else on the bushmeat, I'll bring in Julia, who's got a testimony for us. But if there's anything else, we can do that shortly. So what do you ladies think?
I think Nancy covered it all there.
Okay, well, all righty. Well, me too. And she's graciously been on hold for quite some time. And for the audience, I'd just like to let the folks know that the music you heard at the beginning of this show this evening was composed by Julia Newman. And I have in the description part of the site of Vault of Kidding Talk, Blog Talk Radio, a link to her website where people can go and check it out. So without further ado, I will open up the mic for Julia. Julia, thank you very much for calling into the show.
Thank you for having me. It's been very interesting learning more and more about this organization that I already have fallen in love with.
And thank you very much for providing the opening music for us as well.
Oh, absolutely, and that was such a pleasure to be able to do so. And I selected those tracks actually because I took part in scoring two movies that took place in Africa. My husband is a composer as well, and we wrote the music together for these two films, and they both have very sad subject matter, and one is basically poaching children in a way. It was believed in Zimbabwe that if you have AIDS and you rape a virgin child, you'll cure yourself of AIDS. And so we found out about this from the director, and out of the labor of love and to spread awareness, we wrote the music for this. And it just kind of reminded me of the poaching of animals, you know, taking something so pure and taking it for yourself. So I just thought it was a similar sentiment. And the other one is more about marital, just the marital violence. In another part of Africa. I'm forgetting the place for a second, but so I just thought that the mood of that music kind of reminded me of the sadness that goes on in Africa. But on a more uplifting note, the orphanage was definitely one of the highlights of our trip to Africa. And I first found out about it when I saw the IMAX movie Born to Be Wild. And I said to my husband, I really, really want to go to this place and meet these baby elephants, even more than going on a safari. I just have to go there. And I had never seen so many little baby elephants at once in one place with blankets on their backs. And I remember seeing images of kicking the soccer balls around. And I was so touched by the compassion that the keepers had for these little elephants and the bonds that they formed with them. It was as if they were their little children. And I had never seen something like that before. And they're just all so gentle with these little baby elephants. And I thought, I just have to see this for myself. And as it turns out, our first stop was in Kenya. It happened to be the same town as the orphanage. And it was just all organically happened that we stayed with a friend that was only 3 blocks away from this place, or very nearby. So she took us a couple of days after we arrived, and my husband and I went, and we stood behind this just a little rope that was just separating us from the elephants, and we waited for about 15 minutes, and then all of a sudden, 20 baby elephants came coming in for their morning milk, and they just trotted in single file, and they just excitedly took their milk from these giant bottles. And it reminded me so much of dogs, how they just, the way they were interacting with the keepers and taking the milk, and they just looked so happy, like this was their happy time of the day. And while watching this, I saw a big crowd of little school children watching and smiling and laughing, and I thought, how great is that, that they're getting this exposure so young, and they could fall in love with these little baby elephants too, and it will have an impact on them, so that when they get enticed to poach for money, hopefully they'll think twice as to their childhood experience and not want to go that route. And I had a couple personal things that happened to me on that very day at the orphanage when I was watching them getting their morning milk and playing in the mud and rolling around and having fun. One of the smallest little elephants, must have been a couple months old, came walking up to me, and he nudged me with his little head, and I pet him on his head. I'd never touched an elephant before, so that was very exciting for me. And then from that moment, I thought, oh, I must foster one. And after we got to see them play and eat and everything, they had a talk after, and they told us and educated us how these babies got there and why some of them don't survive and why some of them do survive and just the whole problem with poaching, et cetera. And it just inspired me more and more to want to foster one. And so I did. And as a gift, they invited us to come back and watch them go to bed and have dinner. And so we came back that evening at around 5 o'clock. And there they came back from their day in the wild, and they all came running in, single file. They seem to be the thing that they just instinctually know what. That's how they do it. It's very organized in a way. And they all know where their den is. It's like each one has their name on it, and they all just run in, and the keeper is waiting for them to give them their milk and their branches and leaves, whatever it is. And they all have a big pillow to fall asleep on, and they have a blanket. It's like a little child. And so I said to my husband, I got to find that little baby that nudged me with his head that morning. And I found that little guy. And he came up to me as if he remembered me. And he jumped up on his hind legs and then wrapped his little tiny trunk around my arm and gave me a kiss and sucked on my fingers. And I just was blown away. I had no idea that I would get that kind of response and that he would trust me like that. And the keeper said that one thing elephants do have is that they know how to read your heart. And this one loves you is what he said.
No.
And from that point on, I got such a surge of compassion and this adrenaline rush that I still get when I look at these babies. I'm on their Facebook. The Sheldrick Wildlife Trust has this amazing Facebook page that I liked, and I'm so glad I did because they show videos of rescues and orphans that they saved that day, different things that are going on, new friendships that were made. The first, between the elephants, the first elephant that I fostered at the orphanage that day, her name was Canuck, and she was in a den with another baby elephant, and this was the only den that had two in it, and I asked, why is this? And the keeper said, well, these two became best friends when they met at the orphanage, and they just cannot be separated. They cry, they make all this noise if they're separated. And it goes to show you that they really have an emotional complexity. And I am so touched by how they've formed these friendships with each other. And I was told that a big part of their survival is that when they come in totally traumatized because they've lost their families, they're warmly welcomed by the other babies that surround them and give them care and love. And you see pictures of this on the Facebook page of the trunks wrapped around each other, and just the support they give to one another is just so incredible to see. And I think that's why I had such a reaction to them, is that you could see how emotional and sensitive they are. And each one of these men that works there is seriously a hero. Each one is so compassionate and so sensitive to these animals. They even talk to them in this really gentle way. It's like they know that the elephants respond to a certain gentle tone of voice. And they have families of their own. I've talked to them, and I said, this must be quite a dedicated job you have. And they said, well, we just love each and one, every one of these elephants. And yes, we do have families at home, but this is our other family. And they live there, you know, half of their lives. They sleep there. And they told me that these elephants, they don't want to sleep by themselves. They don't have their mommy to be with them, so their caretaker becomes their surrogate parent, and they sleep with them each night, and they rotate them around so they don't get too dependent on each carekeeper. And I also got to meet the famous Daphne Sheldrick. She happened to be there that day, and I just gave her a huge hug, just saying to her what a hero she is. And she was just she felt like there's just so much more to be done. I could tell she was, you know, quite humble about it. But I think starting our trip this way was really the right way to do it, because when we went out on safari after that, seeing these baby elephants in the wild with their families was so much more profound, because it's like, this is how it's supposed to be for these little guys. Mm-hmm. And there was this one particular moment when this herd of elephants walked by the car, and there was this one little baby that had these huge ears, looked like Dumbo, and he was swinging his like little trunk around. He was like trotting around and hopping around like a happy little guy. He even looked like he was smiling, and he was right next to his mama, and he looked as happy as can be. And our guide says, now that is a happy little elephant, because he feels safe with his family. And I just cried. I was so overcome by this that this was just, I just felt from that point I have to do something. I, even back in America, back in Los Angeles, I could still spread awareness and you know, help in some way. And so I'm really glad that I got invited to be on this program tonight to share that experience.
Well, we definitely appreciate you coming in. I was glad we were able to get this all together. It definitely took, as you, all you ladies know, it took a little time to finally get all the scheduling together, but I think it's well worth it, because, you know, this, you know, to what everyone here, that, you know, part of the reason why, of course, you know, I want to have you on is to increase the awareness of what's going on and, you know, over there in Kenya, especially with the poaching. That's something I'd like to touch more on definitely tonight, because that's something that really, it just really gets under my skin when I think about that, because I think it's just such a waste, and it's such a horrendous waste to use any kind of animal for just one part of their body. I mean, even if, I you know, someone goes hunting, you know, I'm one who says, well, you know, you don't go hunt just for a certain part, you use it all. You know, that's, you know, But to use something just for financial gain, just for one piece of, you know, the animal, it's such a waste, and it's horrible. And it, from my understanding, it's a very suffering process for the animals as well.
Yeah.
Well, when we were on our safari, actually, I mean, thankfully we didn't see any poachers themselves, but we did see the evidence of poaching quite a bit. I forget exactly which park it was, but it was full of those upside-down trees. I think they're called bamboo trees, and they're hollow inside. And the poachers discovered that, well, these trees would be great for poaching, because we can cut a big hole in them, hide in there, and stack our ivory up in there. And it went, before our guide told us this, we thought, these trees just looked like they were kind of like spooky Halloween kind of trees, and they just mm-hmm. naturally got hollowed out over time. But what was so ironic and poignant is we saw this elephant family walking by one of these trees with the big holes, and just was, of course, completely oblivious and just eating the grass, walking by that tree. And that just kind of struck me.
If I may chime in for just a moment, Julia, about that,
sure.
Because you're painting a picture of that tree in the wind,
yes.
And I think you described it very well as a Halloween-like setting. Because, I mean, you think about Halloween and you know, it's, I mean, Halloween's actually my favorite holiday, but, you know, but, well, I'm Celtic, I'm Irish, so that's why, but when you think about Halloween and the fear that Halloween brings to some, you know, and,
right.
and the whole horror thing around there, I just think that tree, in the way you just described it, I think really paints a picture of what that tree really is. I mean, it really
mm-hmm.
is something used for something horrible and fearful.
Yes.
You know what
yes.
I mean?
Yes. Yes, very well put. In a way that even makes more sense why they call it an upside down tree, using it for an alternative purpose. And
mm-hmm.
they don't even have. I guess at the time of year we went, which was in June, they didn't have a lot of leaves on them. So it's like they actually literally look like they're upside down. The roots are sticking up on the top. So they look scary. They look like Tim Burton trees or something.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really interesting seeing that juxtaposition with the elephants and really any animals going by. So it's really a shame. I knew about poaching coming to Africa, but I had no idea how extensive and how desperate the people are, and that's what's been driving them. I mean, forget having a conscience. They just think this is a quick way to gain a lot of money and survive. And I know that a famous basketball player from China had visited the orphanage a few weeks back, and he's become a spokesperson to spread the word to China that this just is not cool. So I'm just glad to see that advances like that are being made. And I just saw today that that Born to Be Wild movie is still playing on the big IMAX screen in L.A. So that's really great. So I'm just really excited about all the different things that they're doing.
And when we talk more about poaching, and you mentioned China, and I believe that's actually one of the countries that said this is something that spans internationally. This isn't just something that's going on in Kenya. This is something that is you know, overreaching. I mean, it's just outreaching, you know, through and affecting a lot of countries. And through my understanding, China is actually one of the, please someone correct me if I'm wrong, one of the large markets for the items that people get from poaching.
It's the largest market, and as Japan as well, but China is the worst. And it's, you know, they are paying like $1,000 per kilo for ivory. And as more Chinese get wealthy, it's a status symbol for them to have some trinket, you know, made from ivory, which is, and they think that they can just, they don't kill the elephant, they just cut their teeth. It's not true. The animal is killed in the most horrible way, and they cut their faces half off to take the ivory. And, you know, and it could be a mother with a baby, and the huge tuskers that used to be everywhere in Kenya but now are rare to see because a lot of them are being killed. So the pressure, you know, on the animals is horrific. So that's one thing that, you know, we try to educate people, don't ever buy anything made from ivory or animal parts, you know, because it's very likely that the animal was killed illegally to get that part.
You know, the kind of reminds me of things I'm sure you folks have heard of before is the term blood diamonds. Kind of reminds me of something like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's blood ivory. That's what they are called. They also, you know, not only they do snares, horrible snares for the elephants where they put like nails in these pieces of wood, and they are poisoned, so the elephant steps on those, and, you know, they walk a few miles and die. And they also were putting poison in pumpkin or some other vegetables and leaving them around so that the animal comes and eats that and dies. So it's, and also, you know, from not only they have the threat from the Far East, which, you know, is the huge demand for ivory. They also have the Somalians coming to Kenya and going to the national parks, killing the elephants with machine gun. And then, that's what they use to fund their wars over there. So it has been, it's a huge, huge threat.
I wanted to add something to that.
No, go ahead. I'm just a host. Go ahead.
I was also noticing we were in Kenya, Tanzania, and Rwanda, and the guys were telling us that China, or I think some other Asian countries, were a big part in helping making the roads. So they have quite the relationship with Asia, and I think, you know, it's like, we'll give you ivory and we'll get, you know, money from you and good roads from you. It's like they have this symbiotic thing that they think is great. But, you know, so I think that's fueling it, too. And I was reading that 2011 was the worst year for elephants that I think they've had.
Yeah, well, this year is even worse.
Oh, no.
Yeah. But you're right. You know, China is everywhere in Africa. They're investing in roads and construction projects because they want to get the natural resources that Africa has. So as you see, like, I saw a road that was being built close to Samburu National Park. And the poaching, I was talking to the people from the park, and they said poaching, wherever the Chinese are building the road, was the worst area for the poaching. Because they will pay a local, you know, a few dollars to go kill an elephant and bring them the ivory, which they try to smuggle out of the country. So that's a huge, huge problem.
Yeah.
So you also mentioned, so I'd like to get back to this, if I may, before I rudely interrupted Julia.
No, I rudely interrupted as well.
No, it's okay. I'm just joking around.
I know.
Anyway, no, but you were talking about Somalia, people from Somalia coming in and shooting with machine guns, and they're using this ivory to fund their wars. I think that's a very important and poignant point to make. Which they don't sound fast. Point to make. Do you have any more information on that, or maybe that'd be something for the folks to do some more research on?
Well, you know, Somalia is a country with really without a government. It has been ruled by those outlaws, I guess, they're rebels that have overthrown the government, and they have done horrible things to the country. They are the ones who are the pirates that usually hijack ships around the Horn of Africa, you know, where people always get hijacked over there. And unfortunately, they are on the northern border with Kenya. And that area of Kenya is very much a desert. And there are actual Kenyan citizens. There are of Somalian heritage. So they are a Somalian tribe, but they were born in Kenya. So those that are born in Kenya many times protect the ones, give cover to the ones that come from Somalia into Kenya to, you know, they steal the other tribe's cattle, they go into the park, they, you know, they kill the animals, and if they are confronted, they are so heavily armed that, you know, the Kenya Wildlife Service, they have little guns, and those guys have machine guns.
Yeah,
so
I was going to ask you how do you protect all that land? I mean,
not easy. It's not easy, you know, and Kenya. The whole budget for all the Kenyan parks is only like $60 million. You know, it's a poor country. So that's why the trust puts all this, a lot of the money that comes in goes into the Tsavo National Park to protect so that the elephants and the other animals have a safe place to live.
Do people eat elephants as well? Did you mention that?
You know, I haven't seen, but I've heard that there's a highway, the main highway in the country is from Nairobi to Mombasa, on the coast.
Yeah.
And there are trucks, you know, every other car is a truck. So mm-hmm. every other vehicle is a truck. And sometimes the elephants cross from one side of the park over the highway to the other side, and they have been hit by a truck or, you know, a car, and they die. And mm-hmm. in a minute, people come and just cut up the pieces and take them home.
Wow.
Which is quite dangerous, you know, to eat
yeah.
wildlife, because they could
yeah.
have some kind of disease.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So.
Definitely. And I also had a question for you. Like, does ivory ever grow back on an elephant if it were cut off by accident? Or
the
I'm
teeth
is,
you know, what they are teeth. They're two teeth. Okay?
Oh,
and they grow until their entire lives.
Longer and longer.
Yeah. I was lucky enough to see an elephant that was probably in his 60s. And
yeah.
actually, it was the same one that was in the IMAX movie, Born to be Wild.
Mm-hmm.
And his tusks, actually, it looked to me like they hit the ground. They were huge. And, you know, I took a lot of pictures of that elephant. And he died of a natural cause, you know, about 6 months later. And each one of his tusks, has, you know, it was one weighed 123 pounds and the other one weighed 125 pounds.
Wow.
That's a huge elephant.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And you're talking $1,000 per kilogram.
Yes.
Ugh.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Wow.
So, you know, it has become like organized crime, like drugs. Because
yeah.
it brings in so much money for the guy that is, you know, selling out in the Far East.
Right.
That, you know, it's the same for the rhinos.
Mm-hmm.
The rhinos, you know, the rhino horn is costs more than gold.
Wow.
So
wow.
if the animal has such a high price on its head, it's very hard for it to survive.
Yeah, we saw a couple baby rhinos at the orphanage as well, and one of them was born blind, and they said that they would have to take care of this rhino its entire life, because there was no way it would survive in the wild, and I this poor little guy, I mean, I felt sad for him, but boy, is he lucky to have been found by these guys.
Yeah,
we don't see so many rhinos in the wild, actually. It seems like they are quite sparse, and we saw one black rhino in the 3 weeks we were there. I could see why they're getting more and more scarce, and I know that they believe that the horns are aphrodisiac kind of motivation there.
Yeah, and also that they accuse cancer or something, which is not true at all.
Right.
Rhino horn is just a fingernail. It's the same material as it is your fingernail. So there is absolutely no truth to the, you know, the story about any of its medicinal use. So.
And if you're caught as a poacher, my guide was telling us that the penalties are not really that severe, so they're not, is that true?
Someone just asked
that's
my question.
That's
oh, sorry.
Very true.
I'm just man. You
can
probably well
know
how to go grow. Go ahead, you know, I'm just going to go and I'm going to get a snack and drink. No, I'm just kidding. But get some more cold medicine probably would be good, you know. No, go ahead.
That's
go
right.
ahead. That's why, well, no, seriously, that's why I keep all three mics open. You guys can go ahead and chat about. I mean, we're getting the information out about it. That's what's important. true. And yeah, I was going to ask, you know, what is the penalty for poaching? But thank you very much, Julie, for bringing that up.
You're very welcome.
They just pay a fine. Sometimes they might go to jail
for
a few months, and they are out and probably doing it again. You know, until they start doing some serious, drastic measures, this is not going to get any better.
Can I ask a question?
Fine. Oh, that kills me. Because it's like, you know, it's kind of like, you know, like a tax on something or, you know, like, oh, well, if it pays more to go ahead and break the law, if you're just going to get fined for it, not taxed, but you're just going to get fined for it, so it's more lucrative to go ahead and break the law.
Exactly.
Because the amount you're going to make over what the penalty is, you might have to go ahead and do it.
Yeah,
right.
That's what's happening.
It's like it's part of overhead. Oh, well, we're breaking the law. We got to find a fine. Write that off as overhead. Heck, you know, the way some governments are, they probably get to write that off. As, you know, okay, I'm being facetious, but.
Yeah, unfortunately, that's true.
Well, where does the government stand on this? Do they, why, is it that because they're getting advantages from the, you know, Asia and so forth, that they're being more lenient for other reasons? They just turn their heads. I mean, have people come to the government begging them to be stricter?
Well, I think it's just their judicial system that, you know, doesn't seem to place a lot of value on wildlife.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, they can shoot an animal, but if you shoot a poacher, there was one canyon that shot a man that was poaching his land,
mm-hmm.
and he went to jail.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, someone asked that in the chat. They're like, "Well, can you shoot a poacher?" Which would be, of course, my first reaction. Did I say
right.
that out loud? But anyway, but seriously, so the guy's poaching on. You know, that's kind of some of the laws here in the United States that I don't get. Like, so if someone's robbing my house,
mm-hmm.
and I have a gun, and I shoot them while they're robbing my house, why would I get in trouble? But it's kind of something like that. So this guy is poacher girl, you know. Is poaching on someone's land, and the landowner shoots them, even though that person that they're poaching probably has a gun, then the person who shot the poacher is the one who gets in trouble.
Yeah, that's exactly right. It's ridiculous, but that's what happened.
Do you know how people have gotten involved in poaching? Like, do they recruit young people?
Ooh, young people, or
well, you have to remember that Africa is a poor continent, and you have a huge population that have, you know, that just subsist. They don't have much at all. They live with very little.
Mm-hmm.
And if somebody comes to you and say, "Okay, go get me an elephant, and I'll give you $50."
Mm-hmm.
$50 for that guy is probably, you know,
mm-hmm.
huge amount of money.
Right.
They're paying more now because, you know, of the high demand. But it's what he can't make someplace else. So, unfortunately, that's, you know, the motivation is they can make money when they might not have a job or...
Right.
You know, not to have a way to feed their family.
Mm-hmm.
So the money in China has, unfortunately, you know, not been good for wildlife. They have done some good things in the country, but I think their track record on environment and animals is not the best.
How long have they been fueling, you know, the ivory trade?
Well, you know, if you in history of China, but it's not only China. I was in Denmark, and I went to see the crown jewels of the Danish Empire,
mm-hmm.
and it had a whole wall, you know, like a cabinet full of ivory, all kinds of carving.
Wow.
So it used to be like normal. People didn't care. They just shot the animal and carved, you know, it was a symbol, a status symbol. And in China, it still is.
But
they're not understanding. They just leave the rest of the animal there, correct?
Yeah, it just stays there to rot.
Yeah, I saw horrific pictures of that. They gave us this booklet from the orphanage, and they showed elephant full elephant with the whole face cut off, just rotting.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's important that they put these realities in there so that people really understand the weight of. Of the situation and what happens to them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's not all just cute little baby elephants.
It's
you know?
Horrible. It's a very awful way to die, you know?
Yeah.
And it causes a lot of problems in the elephant society as well because they kill the older elephants, which are the ones who teach the younger ones. You know, and they live in families the entire lives. The females, the males, when they are 15, they leave the herd and they hang out with other males. But the females live in families the entire lives.
And what I didn't understand is why they kept finding these baby. Orphan elephants alone wandering around desperately, and I thought, well, weren't they part of the herd? Why didn't they run scared with the rest of the herd?
Sometimes they get separated from the herd.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
right?
If the herd is running away from humans shooting at them,
panic.
Yeah. And then the babies get separated. Sometimes they fall in wells.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I read that too.
Yeah.
They fall in a well?
Yeah, because the cattlemen dig holes in the ground so that, you know, to find water, so that the cattle come and drink the water. Well, the baby elephants are walking around and they fall in there, and the mothers cannot get them out.
I see.
So a lot of them become
orphans. That's a
orphan.
Big well.
Yeah.
Yeah, it seems like about half of them that have been rescued in the last couple of months that I've been reading have been saved from wells.
Yeah.
And I fostered a few of them. This organization, it's pretty hard to ignore these rescue videos and the new little orphans that get rescued. They do such a good job. You know, they all get a name where they were rescued from, and they show these really adorable pictures, and some of them are just very emotional to look at. One of them was found standing underneath a truck because it reminded him of his mother. They would stand up. It made sense, you know. That's how they are. They walk around underneath these giant bodies. And so I just remember this image of this little baby elephant standing under the truck getting rescued. And then there goes another $50. That's number 5 that I've fostered since I've been back for the last couple months. And
you're like,
you know, I know. Yeah, it's just their eyes. There's something with their eyes. They're just so compassionate, and they have these long eyelashes, and they remind me of puppies. And I learned that when an elephant dies in a herd, they'll return to the burial ground, and they'll actually have some sort of elephant ceremony. And people have said that they've seen elephants actually crying tears.
Yeah, they mourn their dead.
They do, right.
Yeah.
That's just amazing. I mean, in a way, it's kind of like it humanizes them or something. It's just, I don't know if other animals do that. It just seems like elephants have a superior emotional intelligence.
Yeah, Daphne says that they are the most human-like animal.
Yeah.
So, and emotions, and, you know, they get happy, they get sad, they get,
right.
They are competitive with each other,
mm-hmm.
and they are caring, they get mad, and they, if one does something to make the other mad, then they get even. So they are very much like us.
Yeah.
When the babies arrive at the nursery, they are traumatized because they've seen their mothers being killed.
Right.
And a lot of them have nightmares at night. And they don't want to play. They stay by themselves. You can see in their faces that they are sad, they are mourning.
I can see that on some of the youngest ones.
Eventually, when they begin to play, is when they are healing. So, so they are quite an interesting animal.
I remember seeing some sad faces, and the most vulnerable youngest ones, when they came for their feeding, they had a blanket up with holes in it, and it was kind of off to the side, and they were saying that makes them feel more comfortable. They're a little bit more shy around the other people and the elephants, and sticking their trunk through that blanket somehow emulates drinking from the mother. And it was just kind of interesting to see that. And they even tipped the bottles at a certain angle to imitate the angle in which the baby is sucking from the mother.
That's right.
So there's a whole skill to it. I've been reading up on this since I've been back. There's this great book. I don't know if you guys have heard of it, The Elephant Whisperer, from Lawrence Anthony. Yeah, so I've been learning about that from that. So, I don't know. I mean, I think you can learn a lot from how animals behave.
Absolutely.
And
there's
how did you get in? I'm sorry.
I was just going to say, there's definitely some interesting things about, you know, I've learned this evening. Of elephants that I didn't know. It definitely bears more research on my part that I didn't know before tonight.
Well, good.
And so, how did you get involved in the organization?
Me?
Yeah.
I saw them on Animal Planet. So they had this elephant diaries that ran for the whole week. And was filmed in Nairobi, then at Ithumba and Voi. And I thought that was so interesting. Couldn't believe baby elephants could play soccer. So I went online and I began to read the stories, and I was really amazed. So I did like you. I adopted one and two and three. And pretty soon I decided I better go visit and see if this is really what it looks like. So I went there, and it changed my life. It was really wonderful, and I'm so happy to be a part of the organization.
Now, speaking of that, I think that's a good segue to just, you know, random question I've got here. It's not quite random. I want to ask it, but about the orphan program and the sponsorship or fostering program, how much is that, and what does that all do? What does the folks, I mean, do you know how some of these fostering programs, people, they get pictures or what have you, or updates on how the, you know, what they're sponsoring is doing? So how's the setup for that? And how much is that? What's the cost on that?
Nancy?
When someone fosters an orphaned elephant, the cost is $50 for 1 year.
Wow.
And we, because we want to, as much as a contribution go toward raising the orphaned elephant, we don't mail anything for that contribution. We everything is done online, so they will receive a downloadable link about their orphan. It will include a watercolor.
Well, that saves paper,
then,
too, which I'm all for. Go ahead.
Yes. We're huge in that respect. So they receive a downloadable link about their orphaned elephant, and every month for 12 consecutive months, they will receive information about their elephant. When the keepers are watching the elephant during the day, they write down notes about what the orphan's been doing, and then they compile a newsletter based on those notes. So it's really interesting. It's almost like reading about kids and what they've been up to. So,
that's great.
You know, they have their little fights, and you know, so and so is best friends with so and so, and so the newsletters are really interesting. And then at the end of that, it expires. If someone chooses to renew, they can, and if not, then it just expires.
Okay.
I'm sorry to interrupt you. Most people can. Several people can foster the same orphan, so that's kind of a common misconception, because the actual cost to raise an orphaned elephant at the nursery averages about $10,000 per year. They actually eat every 3 hours. They have a bottle every 3 hours. So that's a lot of milk.
I can imagine.
Also why the keeper sleeps with them at night, because they need to have their feedings throughout the nighttime as well.
Yes, they need to be fed.
That's almost like being with a baby, you know, like a human baby. Like, I've got to get up and feed the little one.
Exactly, that's how it is.
Exactly right.
They are never left alone. They are with the keepers 24 hours a day, because when they are babies, they are never left alone by their families under normal circumstances. And the entire family takes care of the babies, not just the mother, but the sisters, the aunts, and the grandmothers, whatever. Everybody participates and takes care of the baby.
Mm-hmm.
So they are watched 24 hours a day, and the keepers sleep right in the stockade with them.
Yeah, the baby elephant would have like a big pillow and a blanket on top of some hay, and then the keeper would have a bed right next to him or her in the den. And it's partially outdoors, so it's pretty hardcore. You have to be very dedicated. These men they really see it all. I mean, they've got to have such a heavy heart at times. It must be so hard not to get so attached to one after the other, because now that I've fostered several, a couple of the ones that I fostered already died. They had only been there a couple weeks, and they're so vulnerable when they arrive, and especially if they didn't have enough nourishment from the mother in the beginning, or it depends on how traumatized they are. Some are so distraught that they don't have the willpower to want to live anymore. They actually are so depressed they just want to die.
That's
true. Terrible.
And the other orphans are the ones that actually, you know, encourage them and kind of take care of them and try to tell them, hey, it's going to get better. We're here to help. It's very cute.
Yeah, it's true. You could see the way they were playing together in the mud and splashing each other with the water. I mean, there's some great times are to be had there, too. It's kind of a magical, it's a house of healing for these little guys, you know?
Wow.
So,
how old are they about when you, I mean, like, I'm sure it varies, you know, I'm sure it varies, but what's like the age range, of the elephants when they come into the orphanage, or when they're found? Because I know you guys actually go out and rescue them. For the folks out there listening, real quick, and give a little plug for my website. You can actually find a video. Of course, they can. You guys will supply some places for the folks to go to, but also there's a link to a video that shows a rescue on the Bard's Logic website as well, which you can find the link at the front part of the or the homepage of Blog Talk Radio for the show. And so go ahead. And there's also on the Give page of Bard's Logic a link to the donation page of the Sheldrick Wildlife Trust. So if folks can go to that and donate or foster a baby elephant, you can either do it directly through them, or if you are already a visitor to Bard's Logic, then you can use the link that is provided there. Thank you, guys.
The babies come in at different ages, from days old, and if they're older than three, they can survive by themselves, so they don't really need to be brought to the orphanage. But if they're younger than that, they usually are brought in because they cannot survive without milk. So.
Mm-hmm.
But, and also the website, I forgot to mention that the website for the trust is sheldrickwildlifetrust.org. And we have all the information there.
Are you guys still there?
Yeah, I'm still here. Did it get quiet?
It got very quiet. I was like, is it over?
A moment of silence. How about that?
A moment of silence for the elephants that have moved on.
There you go. There you go. Yeah, Sam, oh my gosh, when you're telling me about, you know, your orphan one. Now, how does that work? If someone could tell me, how does that work? So let's say you've orphaned or fostered one of the baby elephants. And the and you do your 1 year. Now, and the unfortunate happens that one of them pass on. Then I guess the fostering goes over to a different elephant.
That's what happened with me. They transferred it to another one need, and I was glad that that happened. And then I got updates on that elephant. And so, you know, I just want that money to go to support, you know, any of them. So I think that's a great way that they deal with that.
Okay, great. Yeah, I thought that was probably the case, but for myself, I just wanted to clarify that.
No, it's a good question, and, you know, it's heartbreaking when it happens, and you want to know why that happened. And, you know, sometimes they it takes a couple of days for them to compile their information, so I just get a quick blip about it, and then I'm like, oh, no, what happened? And then you'll get a whole summary a few days later, it really going into detail medically what happened or, you know, what circumstances brought the elephant there and so forth. They're very good about the information that they compile on them, just factual information, their day-to-day lives, pictures, as I was saying, you know, these little video clips.
What happens most often when they pass away is the younger they come into the nursery, the more at risk they are for not surviving because they've missed those important days of getting the mother's milk with the antibodies. So once they start teething, even if they seem to be doing very well, once they start teething, it's a critical time for them. They can contract pneumonia, and they just deteriorate very quickly. So it's very heartbreaking for the people of the trust as well.
They are huge animals. They are very, very fragile.
Yes. And Daphne thinks of every one of the orphans as her children, and she can tell you what's going on with them just like they're her kids. It's amazing because there's so many, and she knows what's going on with every single one of them at any moment.
Yeah.
Well, now, you mentioned earlier, real quick. I apologize for that. I'm a little under the weather, and I had to cough, and I didn't want to do that on air. So anyway, now you mentioned earlier you have, like, did you say 8,000 square miles for the for the orphanage, or did I hear that correctly?
No, that is the size of Tsavo National Park.
Okay.
The nursery in Nairobi is located in Nairobi National Park, And that is a smaller park. And then by the time they are three, they are transferred to either Voi, which is in Tsavo, or Itumba, which is also in Tsavo. And that is 8,000 square feet. The trust itself does not own...
Square miles.
Yeah, square miles. sorry.
I know, I'm just messing up.
But the trust, but that belongs to the government. You know, all wildlife in Kenya belongs to the government. So the trust is just there to rescue and rehabilitate them, and then you know eventually set them free in the park. So far, over 100 elephants have been successfully being reintroduced into the wild, and they live as normal wild elephants.
In these parks, I'm imagining that they do have efforts to curtail poaching in the parks, correct?
They have what?
They have efforts to stop poaching in the actual parks. I'm sure they...
Well, that's what our desnaring teams and anti-poaching teams do.
Okay. So
they,
assist with that. That's you guys.
Well, mostly yes, because they have limited amount of money, the Kenyan Wildlife Service.
Mm-hmm.
So they partner with private organizations like David Shelter Trust, and then we are the ones who fund the anti-poaching teams the desnaring teams and. We also give them fuel for their, sometimes their cars don't even have fuel. So the trust gives them fuel, get them spare parts for their, make sure that their vehicles are working. And that's why it is so important for people to support. All
you guys are actually helping the government.
We do.
Sounds right. Uh-huh.
Yeah. The trust does help, thousands and thousands of dollars a year is to help the Park Service do the jobs in the park because they would not have enough money and the wildlife would suffer. So part of the money that people give, goes for that.
Wow, incredible. Well, and that's a great organization, what you guys do over there, and as I said, helping them out as well, which that's probably rare. You probably don't hear very often of an organization actually helping out a government. So that's that's something that's definitely interesting. At least for me, because one of my interests is government, so I find that very interesting.
Yeah, it's a struggle, but you have to keep doing it.
Definitely, I understand. And is there any more details? I guess I'm looking at my questions I have here about. Let's see. I want to make sure that we've covered everything that I wanted to cover. And okay, we mentioned about the fostering or adopt. Now you have other animals as well that you have an adoption program. I thought I've seen something about rhinos, and did I actually see something about a giraffe or something? Or
well, I think the other adoption is for rhinos, right, Nancy?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, we have the two rhinos currently at the trust, but we also randomly will help raise a couple of animals. I believe, is it a bushbuck or a dick that we have right now?
I think
a what? I never heard of those.
They are antelopes.
What is
the antelope thing? Okay.
There's so many types of antelopes.
Sorry for calling it that way. The antelope thing.
Oh, the peak is amazing. There's the smallest antelope in Africa, and they have big eyes. They look like little cartoons. They look like little Bambis. They're very cute and kind of neurotic looking.
Interesting. And what are they called again? Because I want to look them up.
It's Dick, D-I-K.
It's
D-I-K. Dick, Dick.
Okay. Interesting. That's
yeah.
just interesting.
They are the smallest antelope there.
Now, one thing is, I know, I just want to touch on this. If you know anything on it, if not, that's okay. Because it is definitely one of my personal passions. And I know this is happening over in Africa. So that's why I'm wondering if you guys would have any information on this. It's a little off topic, and I apologize for that. And it wasn't part of the original interview. It's about, is there in any way deforestation over in Africa affecting what you guys are trying to do?
Very much so, because the destruction of the environment, you know, is destroying where the animals live. You know, people are encroaching in the what has been for millennia the place they lived. So if you cut down the forest, you know, what are they going to eat and where are they going to live? And also it dries up water sources. You know, rivers and underground water. So it's a huge problem. So the trust, that's why, you know, it's one of the efforts for community outreach is to give them each school kid a small tree. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, they go to the park and they plant trees and they take pride in growing their own trees. So, you know, hopefully in the future they will not be there cutting down the trees. But I think the main problem is the population explosion. There are so many people. I've never seen so many little kids in my life. There are
kids
everywhere.
We experienced that too in all three countries. Kids running everywhere, running after our car, running out of their houses, these big groups. And our guide was saying that on average there's 10 children per family.
It's
and these families
insane.
Are so poor.
It's
and, I mean, a lot of the children we met had hearts of gold. I mean, that was actually, this is a little off topic, but we visited a couple villages. One was a Maasai village and another was a local village. And the best part of it was the children. I mean, they all surrounded us with these huge smiles. And they were covered in dirt and flies and they had dried up snot.
Oh.
You know, it was... You kind of had to look past that, but their spirit was so strong and intense, and they're so fascinated with you, and it's like you've made their day just by being in front of them, that it just makes you want to reach out to them as well, just like reaching out to the elephants. It's like they kind of inspire you to want to help them, and yeah, but I can see what you mean. There are a lot of people, and I that's all I have to say about that. That was a part that you know, we had gone on our safari to see the animals, but seeing the people was just as fascinating to watch as well. And
yeah,
just the attitudes.
And you guys have educational programs for children too. You mentioned some of that. If you'd like to elaborate a little more on that and. You're talking about planting trees and things of that nature, no pun intended. But
they show films about wildlife and conservation to the kids in the schools, and you know, all kinds of, you know, radio programs like yours in several different languages.
Wow.
And you know, to try to involve the population into what you're trying to accomplish, because if you there, the conflict between people and wildlife is huge, and you know, so we need to involve them in the solution. So
I think what would be a novel idea, if it was even possible if they could fund this, is that lots of schools get the opportunity to go on one safari as a child, go to the Mara for just one day and see these animals in the wild for yourselves in front of your eyes, and then you get that real connection. Because I think the problem, and especially being, I mean, and it obviously is happening in Africa too, there's just when you're so removed from it and you're told that animals are just a means to an end, and you haven't had a prior connection to them being free in the wild, how could you possibly have that sort of respect for them? And I know that and we have zoos out here, of course, in the U.S., and that's educational for us. But, you know, for me, I've only ever seen these animals in captivity. And seeing them in the wild is one of the most powerful things I've ever experienced. I had no idea how fascinating that would be. And I somehow thought that just living in Africa, the animals are everywhere and they would be more exposed to it just naturally. But I found out that's not the case. Mm-hmm. And I met a guy in the airport in Kenya on the way to Rwanda. I think we were going, and he was from Zambia or something. And he said that they have zoos there. And I was so surprised. Why would you have a zoo in Africa when they're roaming in the wild? And it seemed it just seems odd to me. And he found that offensive, which I didn't quite understand. But I just didn't understand that they were not, that people were not as exposed to us as I thought they were.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. It's a good point. I'd have to stand to agree with that. You know, if you're right there. I mean, here in the United States and, you know, in other countries, you know, we don't have elephants running around wild, you know, or giraffes or anything of that nature, or rhinoceros. You would think that, you know, yeah, they would have something where instead of having them pent up in a, you know, as you said, in a cage or a created habitat, you know, they would say, oh, well, you know, we'll just have a tram or something, or I don't know. I mean, I'll be honest, I've never been to Africa. But, you know, something of that nature, you know, to go look at them, as you said, in their natural habitat.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's beautiful. It's just an incredible experience. But, you know, a lot of people there don't have enough money to make the trip.
That's
expensive. So,
that's,
you know, one of the things that the trust does is take the kids from the schools not to the stockades. You know, they have these buses that, you know, the kids get on the bus and they go to the stockade and they feed the elephants and they touch them. And, it, you know, it's kind of like a huge experience for them. They are fascinated by it. You can see
That's
it in their faces.
Bet. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
They also send materials home with the students. We have a really nice worksheet that the kids are able to take home. It reminds me of the little Scholastic booklets that we got in elementary school. But they take those home, and that way their thought with that is that the kids don't just forget that field trip in a day. They've always got that little thing to hold on to, and it has little games to play like word searches, and I saw this animal, and I saw that animal. But it's also something that is in front of the parents. So the parents are looking at this too, and they're able to read about the need for conservation at a at a lower level, but it's just something to get in front of the parents as well.
That's great. So
yeah.
Do both of you, do you go back and forth to the nursery and do your work there?
Most of the work we do is over here because we try to, you know, make people aware of the work of the trust and try to raise money for them. And when we go there, we visit the facilities and the programs that we are funding and other programs that the trust is doing, and also just to enjoy it, to have fun.
Mm-hmm.
But I usually go once a year.
Oh, how lucky.
Yeah.
So did you both voluntarily sign up to get more involved with the organization? How do you go about in getting more involved like you are?
Yeah, I called them up and volunteered, and just do whatever, you know, I can. A lot of people, you know, have tried to raise money for the trust and adopt elephants for their relatives instead of giving them Christmas presents. They will, you know, adopt elephants for them.
That's a good idea, actually.
That's a good idea, right?
Someone took that right out of my mouth again. What's up with you guys? No, I'm just kidding. But, but no, that's actually a good idea. Christmas is just around the corner. It's next month is October, and people start planning on – and really, $50 a year is for what it does is very – I mean, a year. I hate to say it, but I'd probably spend more than that at McDonald's a year, you know. Well, I'm always on the go, so I eat a lot of fast food, but – yeah, I should really stop doing that. But oh yeah, just with my schedule, it's terrible. I tried being a vegetarian one time, but I'm like, I don't have time to be a vegetarian.
Lot of people do that, and you know, it's a way to get people involved. So.
And visiting the orphanage, I think it was just a small entrance fee, and that of course goes to support the organization too.
And we sell. Now we have the Dame Daphne's book that she wrote, and we sell that book. That money is also going towards the work of the trust.
Oh, that's great. I collect books, actually. So.
Yeah.
Oh, that's great. I really want to buy that.
It's a great book.
And you can find that on the website?
Yeah.
Yes.
Nancy is the one who's the expert in that.
Yes. The one thing to note is it is for sale on some of the bigger websites like Amazon and Walmart.com, but only books purchased through U.S. Friends or the U.K., will benefit the trust. They're not donating any of their proceeds back to the trust, whereas anything over and above our cost of the book goes back to the trust. So anybody interested in purchasing the book can log on to the website and find the link there to purchase it.
Okay, ladies. Unfortunately, I have like 8 minutes left in here, and I kind of neglected some of the callers. I'm sorry about that, but I want to definitely give you ladies most of the time. But I'd like to see if they chimed in and see if they have a question or a comment. So if we take a few minutes, I'm going to open up your line. And I see it says, it's got a name here. I can't pronounce it because it's like Tickalick or something, or your mic is live.
Thank you very much. It's Tick-Talic. How are you doing this evening?
I'm good.
Excellent.
Thank you for calling in. Sorry for the wait, folks, but as I said, I want to give the majority of the time to the ladies we have on the line here.
No, absolutely. I've enjoyed the program, and I just wanted to call in and tell you that you guys, what you're doing is wonderful, and I wanted to kind of ask you I didn't get to hear the entire program this evening. My apologies. I had a question about kind of a local perspective in terms of like issues with elephant poaching. And I wanted to kind of get your feeling on it. If you already touched on this, I apologize. From the perspective of like the local people, in terms of like them trying to, I guess, come up with funds, for example, and to feed their family and things like that. How do you kind of overcome? Situations where like they. You know, they need to poach to feed their families and things of that sort. Is there have you come up with kind of educational programs to help them to?
Well, it's a very difficult situation. First, you know, we try to let them know, you know, that it is legal for one thing, but when you have so many kids and they are hungry. You know, it's hard to convince this person that, you know, to not to do that, right? So it's a battle for us. And you know, it's, I don't know, the trust hires a lot of people from all the different tribes, and they in turn go to their villages and, you know, do the PR for the trust and for conservation and against poaching with their neighbors, with their villages. And but it's, you know, it's a very serious problem. I don't know if we have a answer for that. Unfortunately, you know, the population explosion has not at all helped the situation of the animals.
Absolutely. No, thanks for sharing that. I just wanted to call in real quick on that. I have a passion myself on this. Actually, I'm working on a master's degree in zoology, and I do a lot of work with conservation myself. So I just wanted to let you guys know that there are people like myself that are very happy that we have people like you in this world that are out there fighting for these animals.
Yeah, you know, Daphne has some, there's something on the website that I find absolutely beautiful, that, you know, her words are, saving wildlife in the wilderness is the responsibility of all thinking people. All life has one home, the earth, and we as the dominant species must take care and protect it. And I find that absolutely true and, you know, extremely important. So.
And with that, I think actually that quote was a good way to do the unfortunate, which is to begin to close out the show. Thank you very much for Nancy and Angela and Julia, excuse me, coming in this evening. It was very informational for myself. I've definitely learned a lot, the things that I didn't know previously. And I do have a couple minutes left, but first of all, I'd like to thank everyone who's coming to the chat. Thank everyone who is listening live either through Blog Talk Radio or through the Bard's Logic website or the other venues that you can listen to this show. Also, thanks for the folks who will be listening to this on the archives tonight. And with that, if we've got about 3 minutes left, so if I'd like to give one more minute to each of the ladies, and then I will close out with the opening song we had this evening, and that song was by one of the guests here, Julia. Thank you very much once again for providing that for us. And
you're
go
welcome.
Ahead, and we'll stop. We'll start with Nancy, and then we'll go with Julia, and then we'll close with Angela. Thank you.
I just want to say, in regard to our caller's question, it is a hard thing to deal with when, you know, people are killing animals for food and to survive. But when people are killing animals for trinkets, it's just, it's horrific, and it's just senseless. There's no need for it.
I have to say I agree. Julia?
Well, another thing on that that was interesting and ironic as
thank
well
you,
is... some of the baby elephants that have been reported wandering around alone have been reported by the villagers, by, you know, the people living in these rural areas that share the same land as the elephants. So there are some compassionate people still out there, and at least that helps a little bit. And I was going to mention to you guys, too, that if there's any way I can musically contribute to your organization, write any sort of music to help promote footage that you guys put together or anything, I would love to donate my music to the Sheldrick Foundation, if that would help at all, drive the point home. That would just be a neat way, I thought, to contribute.
Thank you.
Well, thank you.
And what I could do is I've got each one's emails and phone numbers, so what I could do is I can, you know, email each other.
Connect
the information.
Out, yes,
right. Information. So I'll do that sometime tomorrow with emails. I'll email each other's contact information. And Angela, I've got about a minute left, so go ahead and let's close out
here.
Thank you.
I just want to tell people, please do not ever buy any ivory, any animal products, because, you know, by cutting the demand, maybe we can help save the elephants. And get involved, you know, get your voices heard when, you know, any legislation are passed to help the animals. And just help us protect them.
Definitely. I definitely wholeheartedly agree. And thank you once again, ladies, for coming in tonight. And thank you for
calling.
Thank
you so much.
And
thank
everyone, you are very welcome. Everyone, take care. Have a good night. And please stay, if you would, just to listen to the closing music.
Great. Thank you.